Studio 360.
When I talk to any kind of artist or maker on this show, or even in real life, I love learning the nitty-gritty of their work, including the jargon they use, which is why we've launched a new Studio 360 series called Terms of Art. That's where I talk with all kinds of artists and impresarios about the terms and phrases peculiar to their creative fields. In one of my favorite installments we've done, I got a lesson in film composer lingo from Carter Burwell. Carter was playing in punk rock bands in the early 80s when a friend asked if he wanted to take a stab at writing the music for a super low budget movie. It was being made by a couple of fellow young nobodies in New York named Joel and Ethan Cohen, and it was called Blood Simple. Turns out, Carter had a knack for scoring films, and he has since done the music for most of the Coen brothers. He's also worked with Todd Haynes, Charlie Kaufman, and Spike Jonze, among many other directors. So I asked him to come in and walk me through the soundtrack lingo. First thing I asked, what is temp music?
I would send shivers up my spine when you say it. It's the bane of my existence, and I'll explain what it is. When a director and an editor are editing the film, it's not uncommon for the editor to want to put some music in there just so that when they show the scene to the director, you're feeling something's happening. So it is done all the time. Virtually every film you've seen has had temp music put into it. You, as the audience member, probably don't know what it was, although if you actually thought hard about it, maybe you would know, because the next step is they bring in a composer and play the movie for him with that temp music in there. They've been living with that temp music for a couple of months.
Right, and suddenly it's the music.
It's the music.
It's like writing a novel and saying, and this character is going to be played by Jack Nicholson, this one by Ryan Gosling. So go crazy with whatever you want to make them like, right?
Yes, exactly.
And when you're watching a film that you had nothing to do with, can you say, oh, I see how this went? Can you reverse engineer as you're watching?
Yeah, unfortunately, you can. And I think that now that the listeners know about temp music, you go back and listen to a lot of film scores, you might begin to say, oh, I can imagine what they put in here for temp. I can imagine what they put in here for temp. And it does result in lawsuits. I know Danny Elfman told me once that one year Vanity Fair is doing their Oscar issue where they put all the composers together. They do a layout for each craft, and the composers would not all agree to be in the room at the same time because they had all sued each other.
That's
every one
funny.
Of them had sued someone else in the room.
And I'm sure, and again, Danny Elfman, great big composer of television and film scores. Do directors ever, as they must, I guess, like, oh, the temp was so perfect. Do they ever say like, and it is perfect, and that's what I'm going to use. Sorry.
Well, I like it when they do that, actually. I prefer, if you're going to try to make me sound like something else because you think that the other thing is perfect, you should just go ahead and license that other thing.
So 2001, A Space Odyssey is a famous example. And the opening notes of the film, which people now know as 2001 theme, I guess, of course, is a piece by Richard Strauss from 70 years earlier. One of the most awesome cinematic musical experiences of my young life in 1968. So I never knew that there was a score, right?
There was a score, that's right. Alex North had been hired as a composer. I think he had done Spartacus.
For Kubrick.
And these classical pieces had been put in as temp music. You know, a little bit frightening probably to face as a composer, but Alex North did face it, and he went ahead and he wrote a score. And he's a great composer.
Right.
As I understand it, somehow it skipped Kubrick's mind to tell him that they had never actually put the score in and had went that they had in the end just gone with the temp music. And it wasn't until Alex North saw the film.
Oh, that, well, here is the opening of his score for that same scene in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Which, hearing that, I'm thinking, whoa, 10 years later, John Williams, Star Wars.
Yeah, no, that's right.
So, the next term of art we want to talk about is spotting. What is spotting?
So, spotting is the first sort of official step in a composer working on a film. It's where the composer sits with the director, usually the film editor too, and we go through the film, stop and start from the beginning, saying, okay, there should be music here. It starts here, it ends there. And that's our first chance to say, what is the intention of the music? What am I going to bring to this film?
Do the directors say, oh, like a little bit of this Schoenberg here or a little bit of, you know, Prince here? Is that how the conversation goes?
There are definitely directors who are capable of doing that, maybe who do that.
Yeah.
But I have to say, if I sense that a director knows what they want, that makes the whole project less interesting to me. And
right.
I, you know, I don't really want to
right.
do that. I don't want to do a project where the director says, okay, you can see what this is. Let's just do it.
Do you, all things being equal, would you rather have a director who is musically knowledgeable or like just not?
Well, I have dealt with directors who, well, I'll say Michael Mann, he's known for, you know, being the guy who tells you how the buttons should be stitched on the costumes. And I went through a film with him once and he literally said to me, we're watching a scene, he says, I think strings A minor, D minor.
Wow.
But we didn't, I knew that if he was doing that then at the spotting session, we were not going to be able to survive each other. It was not going to be a pretty picture.
The next term, I suppose, might come up when you're spotting. Is that how we say it? You're
That's
spotting
right.
with the director?
We're spotting.
Is ironic scoring, which is a phrase I'd never heard of, and I love that idea that that's a term. So a director asks you to score a scene ironically. Is that how it happens?
It is a thing that can come up at the spotting. Take any film. Take Being John Malkovich.
The Spike Jonze movie that you also composed.
Which I also composed. We began to gravitate towards the idea that, well, the most disturbing thing, the most uncomfortable thing for the audience would be if we took the story seriously and you actually believed it was possible to go into someone else's brain.
But Dr. Lester.
I am not Dr. Lester. I am Captain Merton.
Take these characters that could be kind of cartoony and make them real.
I don't understand.
It was 90 years ago that I discovered a strange portal. And I found that this portal led to a vessel body and that I could live forever by leaping from vessel to vessel.
You could feel the emotions that were right. involved, and that would be the most uncomfortable and disturbing aspect of the story. So that's, you might say it's ironic.
But it's counterpuntal,
certainly. It's counterpuntal to what you're seeing.
Yeah.
It is, for me, honestly, the way that I see the world, to be honest. So it is often my first reaction
yes.
to a film is to say, okay, what am I not seeing?
Right, right. Source music. What is source music?
Well, source music is music that appears in a film coming from a source on the screen. So a radio, a record player, that's called source music. In the more academic world, it's called diegetic music because it's coming from the diegesis. It issues from the diegesis of
what?
The story.
Yeah.
But that's definitely one more syllable than you'll hear in Hollywood.
Yes.
So typically in Hollywood, you distinguish the source music from the score. And they're distinguished in terms of the function they serve in story because source music is often chosen by the people on the screen. Someone puts on a record.
So right.
That's telling you that person's choice. Whereas what I write is, first of all, is coming from where? You know, no one
the
knows.
The ether.
That's right.
God.
And it's there more to manipulate the audience. It can sometimes be telling you something about the character, but it's a different type of thing.
I'm interested when they blur sometimes in films, and I'm going to play the film you composed, a scene from Miller's Crossing by Joel and Ethan Coen. So two gangsters show up at the house of the character played by Albert Finney, and he's trying to relax and listening to Danny Boy on his record player. So we see the record on the old-fashioned phonograph. He's chilling in bed. And so this is source music because he's playing the record of Danny.
That's right. We see the record.
They enter. They fire. The Albert Finney gangster kills one, jumps out of his house, burning house. So we're not in his room anymore.
Right.
And but the music is going on.
That's correct. When we first heard it, you know, you heard the scratches in the record. It was treated, but once we're out of that room, now the music is full. It's coming from all the speakers in the theater. And it's being treated as score now. Well, the mix, really. Scores, yeah. We sometimes say.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, there's a new term of art.
As he walks outside now with his Tommy gun, he kind of carries the song with him. It's now it's him. It's Albert Finney. He put the record on, and he just brings it with him. And it tells you something about him. It's the song, as you hear. It's very relaxed. The tempo is down. Although this shooting is going on, the music isn't pumping things up. Because he's very relaxed. He's walking calmly down the road with his Tommy gun, carrying on this battle. And that's him. It's telling you about his character. We had Frank Patterson, who's singing. He came in and sang this for us. He really got into it. And we'd say, okay, can you hold that note until the car hits the tree? And then when it explodes, you resolve the note. And he did that. He was really into following the picture. And but yes, that's a place where a piece of source has now become a piece of score. But I think for pretty good reasons, because it's about Albert Finney's character, really, in the end.
So, you've spotted a movie with the director, you've written the music, dealt with the sourcing and the scorcing, you're not done. What are streamers and punches? A phrase I've definitely never heard.
Well, it really goes back to the history of how films used to be scored. Conductor would stand in front of an orchestra in a recording studio. Orchestra's looking at the conductor. Behind them is a huge screen, and the film is being projected onto that screen. And the conductor has to conduct the music so it stays in sync with the picture. And a lot of times there are specific beats you have to hit. I have to be at this bar at this moment. I have to be at this bar at this moment. So the way that was achieved was they would take a crayon and draw a line across the film going from one side to the other. And when the way that appears on screen is as a line moving from left to right, streaming across the screen and telling you that by the time that line gets to the right side, I've got to be at bar 31, and, you know. So that's a streamer. Punches were a way of giving the conductor some metronome information, basically. It'd be just they'd actually take a punch, like you'd punch paper with, and punch a hole in the film, like where every beat was or maybe where every bar was. So he'd see this white dot, and he would know if he had to speed up a little. The conductor would know if he was in time to meet his obligations to the picture.
And do you conduct after you compose your music?
I conduct, all my sessions.
Wow.
That's the fun part of
my job.
I
would think the most fun.
It's the most fun, yeah.
And are you, is it like we've seen in the movies about movies? Is the movie like screening in front of you?
Well, these days it's screening in front of me, but on a tiny screen.
Right.
I'm sorry, they don't really do it that
way
anymore.
It's these days.
So it is a big kick. You know, I spend 95% of my life by myself in a room.
Yeah.
That's what I do as a composer. But for that, those few days when we're recording, it's...
you put on an ascot and tails.
Exactly. And an imperious tone. And that's right.
So as you're syncing the movie with the music, that can be done very tightly where every bit of action, da-da, and then it can be more freely flowing. That's just a stylistic choice of the director and you?
It is.
And when music is too synced up, there's a term for that?
Well, yes. If... There is. It's called Mickey Mousing. If the music, you know, hits, there's a beat for every visual beat, you know, that's called Mickey Mousing. It goes back to those early Disney animations where as the characters bounce up and down and the washing machine bounces up and down and the trees bounce up and down in time with the music, everything's moving always in sync.
And we can even see, as we listen to this, we see Mickey walking.
That's right, exactly.
Are you ever accused of being... Mickey Mousing?
I don't think I've been accused of being of Mickey Mouse saying no. But there are a lot of film styles, types of films that do require that.
Right.
There are, you know, action films where whenever something crashes into something else, or, you know, of course there's a beat of music there. And I'm happy to say those aren't the types of films I typically work on.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know, there may be some, maybe in the animation world they use the term Mickey Mousing as a more affectionate term, but when I hear it, it's usually a pejorative, I have to say.
Yeah. Carter Burwell, this is fascinating, and thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
That conversation with Carter, because it was just the two of us, what we in professional radio broadcasting call a two-way. When there are two interviewees, we call it a three-way, and even some of us snicker at that. What are the special terms of art that you use when you're plying your trade as a painter of murals, or in your special effects studio, or your balloon art business? Let us know at studio360.org.